You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions. This episode is brought to you by our Patreon supporters. Become a patron today at patreon.com/intotheportal. Australia in the 1870s. This formative period in Australia's history was known to be somewhat of a rough existence, at least for some in society at the time. This era became most famous for the wild tales emerging from the outback of ruthless outlaws, cattle rustlers, gangsters, all of them using the cover of the dense brush to hide from the authorities. And some of these men, based on sheer reputation of their merciless nature, would become much more infamous than others. One such man took the crown as Australia's most feared outlaw, Edward Ned Kelly. Beloved Robin Hood to some, and a ruthless murderer and gangster to others, the story of Ned is truly one of a kind. Robbing banks, taking hostages, raining bullets upon police, and of course wearing his iconic metal suit of armor. Join us on Into the Portal as we take a look at the life of Australia's most notorious outlaw, Ned Kelly and the Kelly Gang.
Hello, and welcome back into the portal. I'm Amber Ray.
And I'm Andrew McKay.
And we're back with a brand new full-length episode for you guys.
Yay! I felt like you had to say it that way because we're so used to saying, like, Patreon, because that's what we've been recording lately.
Feels
like it's been a little while since we were on the mic. I guess it's just been a couple of weeks, but we've been releasing the summer series. So Atlantis of Japan was our last full-length episode.
Yep.
So pretty stoked to be back.
Yeah. It's been a nice little break, but at the same time, it's good to be back.
We definitely needed it. Wine industry is a pretty wild one.
It can be exhausting.
It's a little busy for sure.
And yeah.
But we are really pumped for, like, Halloween's coming up, October. We've got a million things on the horizon here for, like, basically just all of fall. Really, really, really cool stuff
happening. Lots and lots of stuff to look forward to. We're getting back into, like, our horror film binging, and we have so many fun things lined up for the next month and for the end of this month too, to lead up into it. And not only that, but of course with our Straight Up Strange podcast network with all of our amazing strange folk, we have some really fun little collaborations that are going to start coming down the pipe next month. So yeah,
exactly.
Lots
so people
to
are teaming
to.
Up in the network. We're also launching the network blog very soon, which is dope because there's already completed pieces and they're all super unique. Like we have some really unique shows in this network.
Yeah, it's super fun.
And it's only growing, so it's going to be dope. Be Strange, we have a clothing line that's coming soon as well.
Yep.
With some really cool stuff that's going to be perfect for fall. We didn't really make it in time for summer, so we have pieces that are going to be ready to go for next year. Mm. But that is coming soon too, so check that out. And yeah, just like hop over to straightupstrange.com. Last thing though for housekeeping, Spellcast. One of the other members of Straight Up Strange, they have a really cool event coming up in the New York area. I cannot remember exactly where, but we have all the information you need. They are putting on a spell con. Like, it's going to be awesome. Like a Comic Con or like a whatever con, they're putting on a spell con where there's going to be a whole bunch of different vendors and different people presenting custom like workshops and stuff like that, all related to like witchcraft and the occult and really cool stuff.
It's going to be really cool.
So make sure you guys check that out.
Definitely, especially if you're in the New York area.
So straightupstrange.com has all that information and you can get to their website and check out their show and all that stuff from there as well.
Yeah, it's like right on the main page. If you scroll past our little logo, you'll see the big banner. You can just click on it and it'll take you right there.
Yeah. All right, well, you want to like jump into this? It's a pretty weird, awesome, unique story we got for you guys. First of its kind on Into the Portal, really?
Kind of. It's more of a biography, a historical biography of a pretty badass character here. We're talking about Ned Kelly today.
Ned Kelly.
He's a pretty infamous gangster, gunslinger, and cop killer in all of Australia and beyond, I would say. Especially in recent memory too, right? There's been a few references in Orlando Bloom film too. Yeah,
there's been a lot. There's been operas on the Kelly Gang, different plays and productions and things like that. You know, folk songs and folk tales, and he's definitely very famous in Australia, less so outside of Australia in just folklore and history in general. But it's funny because we had seen his face a million times over well before we even started doing this show on the label for 19 Crimes, the wine from Australia, because they feature all kinds of gnarly dudes, and Ned Kelly's on one of them.
He is. That was really fun. And we actually were going to buy a bottle of that and drink it while we were recording, and we totally forgot.
Whoopsies. We've got something else here anyway.
Something in the cup.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love this story, and it was all thanks to Andrew for the inspiration for this episode and most of the research, if we're being honest here.
Well, and big shout out to Wes, our buddy.
Oh yeah.
Wes out in Australia, because he kind of like, I mean, I brought the story to his attention in a way, he kind of brought it to my attention in a different angle. And then we just definitely shout out to him because he was interested in Ned Kelly.
Very cool. Yeah. We love Wes.
Yeah.
I hope he's doing good.
Yeah.
But essentially, yeah, this guy was known as a bush ranger. That's kind of cool. Essentially, these bush rangers were mostly escaped convicts, and this was in the early years of the British settlement of Australia. And they used the bush as a place to hide and plan what they wanted to steal, kill, as well as provide refuge from authorities.
I feel like, I'm pretty sure it's bush ranger. I think.
Oh.
With that hardcore like twang of some kind of like.
That's Bushranger.
Yeah.
But I mean, that was a weird accent.
But your version is definitely a cooler name.
Bushranger.
I mean, they're definitely ranging the bush.
Maybe, well, I'm thinking of from Lord of the Rings, right?
Oh.
What was indeed. It? It was the Ranger? No, it was something Ranger.
Are we thinking?
I'm thinking of Viggo Mortensen's character.
Hmm.
Maybe.
But yeah, no, these guys were out in the bush and they were gnarly, gnarly guys.
Pretty much. And these were the guys that essentially, like you already mentioned, right? They have been immortalized in folklore, in songs, romanticized to a certain extent, right?
Yeah.
But the reality was definitely less so. Very risky, horrible, horrible life of poverty, essentially scavenging. Your entire existence is evading the authorities and evading basically all of the population, because if you're one of these people, you are an outlaw and you can be shot on sight by anyone, any member of the public.
Right.
As long as they recognize you and get it right.
Yeah.
And it's kind of crazy. Like, they were often motivated by, just like a desperation to a certain extent. And they knew what was coming for them if they were ever caught. So a lot of times these people ended in a fiery death, essentially, of violence and whatever else.
Definitely.
And yeah, wasn't pretty. And Ned Kelly is no exception, I would say.
Yeah, definitely not. I mean, he was certainly better at evading them and all that. But I mean, yeah, I mean, bushrangers were, there was all sorts of different shapes and sizes of them. To put it like nicely, I guess, like there was ones known as gentleman bushrangers that didn't really, you know, the classic kind of like nobody gets hurt, but everyone gets robbed situation. Then there's the ones at the other end of the spectrum that just killed on sight, took what they wanted. But they were almost always, yeah, like you said, like essentially just, you know, convicts, former convicts or descendants of convicts. Almost all of them are Irish, and it's a shitty life. It's tough. Other than the fact that there's no true winter, it still gets pretty cold in Australia in the winter time there. So yeah, living in the bush would be pretty rough. So Ned Kelly didn't really start, like, that is where his story kind of like went to But first off, like, we'll start at the beginning here. So he was born I don't have the exact date, but June 1855, in the state of Victoria at Beveridge, which is the hilarious name. It's this tiny little town. It's like 2,500 people
nowadays. Do they make cola by any chance? I feel like
they must manufacture beverages of something.
I hope. It's not even spelled the same, but...
No, but I mean, one would hope that just it's there for the picking.
Just by association alone, right?
Totally. But yeah, he was the eldest son of a guy by the name of John Kelly. He was known as like John Red Kelly, and then his wife's name was Ellen, Ellen Nee Quinn. So both Irish. His father was born in the classic location that everyone would know. And I honestly don't even remember where it's from, but Tipperary.
It's
in songs and all kinds of different things.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary.
It's from where we are. Yeah, definitely.
And I guess for them too at that point.
Yeah.
If they're in Australia.
Yeah, right.
That's a long way to go.
So of course this is in Ireland. And yeah, I mean, his dad was born around 1820. Around 1841, he was sentenced to 7 years for stealing two pigs, or at least allegedly stealing two pigs. So he was pretty young, right? Like, he's only 21 years old. And of course, he was sent to Australia, like almost all convicts were at the time. And yeah, shipped over in a boat, arrived roughly 1842. And he's serving, you know, after serving his sentence, he's in there for 7 years. He ended up marrying Ellen and having five children, including, you know, the now infamous Ned Kelly. Edward mm-hmm. Kelly is his real name.
Yeah, that's a long way to go. Could you imagine you just have a petty crime like that and they just ship you right out of the country? That's it. You're done. Pretty convenient.
Just a couple of hogs, man.
Well, put a bit, they probably were prize hogs if that was the case.
I mean, yeah, they must have been. It does seem almost more cumbersome in a way, though, to like do all that to a person just for that. Like for you to have to like have the ships and I guess employ people.
Well, it employed people and it got rid of certain segments of the population that were probably less desirable.
Yeah, no, that was the goal for sure.
Yep.
Political.
Population purification, am I right?
Yeah, I guess that's what they're going for, the Protestants.
It's a lot more convenient back in the day when there was a lot more landmass that you could just accumulate.
Yeah, ship them to Australia, no big deal. This really beautiful place, although everything will kill you there, so it's kind of a double-edged sword.
Another of the many edges of living in the bush.
Yeah, no
Australian
kidding,
outback
right?
There,
You
yeah.
would have to get used to a lot of different creatures. And maybe you'd come across a few alien big cats if you're living out there in the Blue Mountains or other areas of the outback.
That would have been a fun thing if we found a reference.
That would be a hilarious crossover. Could you imagine how sweet that would be? Oh my God, that's awesome. That's almost
crazy.
like the Marco Polo Orang Pendek crossover, although there wasn't much there. We tried, but
it
was
a mention.
Anyway, getting back to Ned here, he kind of, you know, he started off his life relatively normal. He attended school, you know, up until his father died on the 27th of December, 1866. So his mother's now a widow, you know, and they're basically left in a pretty desolate situation. They ended up moving into what was described in multiple sources as a hut at 11 Mile Creek. That is never, if you have the word creek in the place you're staying, it can either go one of two ways. It's either going to be a pretty nice place or you're living in a van by the river, basically.
Basically. At least you got a river. Water source is important.
Well, yeah, I suppose it would be cleaner back in these days as well. So that's positive anyway. But this place was somewhere between Greta and Glen Rowan in northern Victoria. So anyway, this is where one of the Quinns, so this is a guy on Ned's mother's side, one of the family members, so this is Ned's uncle, takes up a cattle run around 25,000 acres. This is in around 1862. So they're kind of doing some, you know, whatever, reasonably respectable things as the family. Like they do mm-hmm. have like real business in
at
the
least,
area.
At least she's got family, hey? Like that's
yeah,
big.
There was a lot of them there. Yeah. Irish families were big back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them ended up in Australia. So it's just hilarious that there was, you know, family members there.
Oh,
I guess some would have come over, you know, not just being shipped as convicts too, I guess. Was that a thing? Later
I don't
on,
know,
maybe not,
to be
maybe
honest.
Maybe not quite this early.
Well, laborers, you know, but a lot of those would have been convicts too.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, nevertheless, although regardless of what you want to believe, if they were trying to be like legitimate business owners or whatever, they were definitely like scrutinized by the police and they were suspected of all kinds of, you know, different things in connection with horse thefts and different just like cattle thefts, stealing farm equipment, you know, typical things, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
that's
it would
a large,
definitely like
large tract of land they had. They're 25,000 acres. Like,
it's
geez.
Yeah. Well, nobody was willing to take a lot of this stuff, right? Like, we've had this conversation with Wesley, where he's driving through the outback and it's just nothing. Like, mm-hmm. you couldn't even give the land away. Some of it. It's like, you could do nothing there. There's nothing for you to do there except for cook in the 50 degrees Celsius heat and die, essentially.
I wonder, though, if it was the case where it's like, you can take up a tract of land, like similar to what they did in Canada, right, with settlers and everything. And you just, as long as you work it and it's, you know, you're using it, then that's yours. And that's essentially what happened. Like, for a number of years, you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. But it would progress into much more of a life as like a bandit, because it wasn't going to work out just, you know, on a cattle ranch.
No. And who knows, like, it could have been a combination of exactly that, right? Like, socioeconomic prejudice and maybe just, you know, the fiery personalities of many of these Irishmen, who knows? But Ned...
They're very endearing.
Ned was definitely one of those. He he kind of reminds me of that Irish UFC fighter guy.
Oh, yeah, like, oh, Conor McGregor.
Yeah, McGregor.
He's got a quality like that, for sure.
I don't know, maybe. But, yeah, so essentially his first sort of brush with the law himself, personally, was in 1869, sorry. He was arrested for allegedly assaulting a, quote, Chinaman, and was held for 10 days until the charges were dismissed. I guess, right. You know, like, that's a personal charge. So if you decide to drop it, then fine, whatever. There's nothing there. But the very next year, he was again arrested, and he was held in custody for 7 weeks.
That's a long time.
Yes.
And custody for 7 weeks?
I don't even know how that's possible, but I guess they just got away with whatever out in the outback.
That's almost 2 months. That's crazy.
That is. That's, yeah, that's just 1 week shy of 2 months. That's crazy. So I guess they're holding him and trying to maybe accumulate evidence. But essentially, this was a different charge. He was suspected to be an accomplice of a bushranger. Did I say that right?
Yes, I think so.
Bushranger, Harry Power. Right. And he was another convict of Irish descent. And he did, essentially, the charges were dismissed again. I guess they couldn't find anything on him.
Right.
And he just went about his business. But another, well, I guess this is literally the same year, he was again convicted. Well, not again, sorry. He was again arrested and then actually convicted of bunches of offenses.
Yes. Bushels.
Bushels and bunches.
Just, you know, boatloads.
They just piled on him.
They were just trying. They were literally, I think they were trying to make an example of him, is like how this sounds.
It really sounds as if the scenario would have been just a very hostile one, right?
Hell yeah.
Between this family
and... They're targeting him, clearly.
Exactly, right? And... Yeah, this time he was sentenced to 6 months. He was released, but then more trouble for Ned.
Never ends.
He was again arrested and convicted of stealing a mare, some sort of horse.
Yeah,
and
cow, some horse. Yeah,
yeah. Essentially, I guess it was in their possession and it was known to have been stolen.
Right.
And so he got 3 years for that.
3 years.
So it wasn't until 1874 he was then discharged from prison, and his mother actually took up another husband. So yeah, George King comes into Ned's life.
Right.
And King is, you know, he's a hard worker. He worked for 2 years as a logger in the bush. Mm-hmm. But again, it seems as if this is a common thing. Stealing horses. He gets in trouble in about 2 years after that. So yeah, this is coming up to 1876 now.
Right.
And this is just, it seems very commonplace. It's the thing to do.
It's an easy commodity to steal, and it's the highest value item that exists where these people live.
I'm more so curious about the political, like the socio-political nature of all this, right? If it's people going back and forth, like, you know, if there's actually like feuds amongst these like folk.
Oh,
like,
there definitely was. So, I mean, yeah, I didn't include that in some of these sections here, but I definitely read through parts where it was, you know, neighbors that were thought to have been close with the Kellys that then would, you know, turn them in and like, you know, plant evidence and like basically like try to like run them out of the community so that they wouldn't get harassed, because they were causing problems for people just by being around after a while, because they became such a focus for police.
I see.
That it was a pain in the ass even for these other people, even if they were a little shady and they were cool with the Kellys earlier on and they did favors for each other. And it was very much like, you know, they're living on like farms and stuff, right? Like they would help each other out.
You need to have a community around you.
And but they would also steal from each other occasionally, right? Like wherever, like throughout different communities. It reminds mm-hmm. me of Trailer Park Boys, like don't steal within the park.
Oh, yeah, you know totally. What
I
mean?
But like
yeah.
sometimes people get pissed off. And yeah, I definitely read some stuff where they tried to kind of, yeah, they were definitely pushing police towards the Kellys.
And the Kellys did see themselves as victims of persecution to a certain degree. And yeah, it kind of contributes, right? It's almost like a cyclical effect, you would imagine, right? Because you get more jaded and then you start doing things that are probably not legal. And then that just reaffirms the existing stereotype or whatever, preconception yeah. and all that jazz.
Yeah, exactly.
And Kelly, like I already alluded to, he's a pretty hardcore guy. He was known to shoot on site, whether you were armed or not. And there were definitely like circumstances where he gained a bit of a dirty reputation in that degree. Hey,
yeah, definitely. That was his reputation. And that was why police were afraid of this guy, man. And he was a crack shot too. He was oh, yeah? apparently a pretty good shot. So he could hit you from a distance away, you know, shooting from the hip with a pistol. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about some pretty gnarly, amazing, awesome, just gone down in legendary fashion suit of armor that this guy wore.
Mm, yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Before we get into all that, though, there's a lot of lead up, obviously.
Oh, hell
and
yeah.
Whether or not these people were simply misunderstood, if they could be even remotely considered an Australian Robin Hood type figure, you know what I mean? All that jazz is mm-hmm. really... It's all for debate, I would imagine. Like, you know, for
me. It depends
me.
Who you talk to.
Well, yeah, exactly. Right? I would imagine a lot of people are set in their ways, and I would imagine there is a spectrum of you know, people's perceptions.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But it gets even interestinger. So Ned, obviously, he's not the only kid in this family, and the laundry list goes on, right? They're embroiled in a lot of different scandals and crimes related to horses, cattle. And like you said already, this district is pretty notorious for all of that. And Ned's younger brother, James, he was similarly sentenced to 5 years imprisonment for cattle stealing. He was released and then he was again sentenced for stealing horses.
They're just ganking
years.
Cows and horses, man. That's what these guys do.
How is it even worth it?
Like, 10 years.
10 years. Like, but it seems as if he learned his lesson. After he was released from jail, he ended up just living out his life and died in, you know, of old age in 1946.
Yeah.
Similarly, Kelly's mother, known as Mrs. Kelly, despite her second marriage, she died a little earlier than her son, obviously. It was 1923.
Yeah.
And yeah, he had another brother, Dan. And he was similarly sentenced to imprisonment for, well, not horses this time. It was actually property.
Yeah.
And then again, after he was released, a warrant for stealing horses. So these people just don't learn their lesson, apparently. Or they are literally being framed. You know what I mean? Like, it could be a case of both.
It's definitely both. That's just the long and short of it, right? Because, like, clearly these guys are not just... They're not saints that are just getting completely, you know, blamed for horse thefts and things like that.
Very true.
But
it all kind of comes to a head at this point, right? Because there is a very infamous incident that happens at the Kelly home. And this was essentially leading up, like, there was a warrant out for Dan's arrest. And so an officer named Fitzpatrick decided that he was going to go and try to arrest him. This Fitzpatrick guy, again, like kind of a...
I had his first name too, and it's not here, but we'll pull it up. But yeah.
It could go either way though, right, with this guy, because he was known to be unreliable and the scenario isn't quite clear. All the facts have been skewed over the years, right? But essentially he claimed that Ned Kelly shot him and tried to kill him, even though we just hit his hand. Do you think Ned Kelly would just hit his hand?
Well, that's just it. He was a crack shot.
Yeah.
If he wanted you dead, you were not going to, especially at like point blank, you're at the door. So, and just to be clear, Dan was the youngest brother. So he's showing up to arrest the youngest brother. And that was like, that right there to me is like obviously it's a narrative that's teeing up like a provoked reaction from the older brother, Ned Kelly. Right.
Yeah.
For him to then say that he tried to kill me, blah, 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 blah. Even though there was witnesses placing him elsewhere at the time and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the interesting part, right? Because who actually did shoot him then? Did he shoot himself in the hand? Did someone else in the family shoot him in the hand? Like, I don't know.
He could have shot himself. You never know. We don't know the personality of this Fitzpatrick character.
Yeah. But this is kind of where everything kind of kicks off, right? Dan has to go into hiding.
Yeah.
Mrs. Kelly, along with her son-in-law and also a neighbor, were all arrested and charged with aiding and abetting this attempted murder of Officer Fitzpatrick.
Yes.
And they were tried in October of that year and convicted at Beechworth. And that came up in our Airedale Asylum episode,
yes,
I think.
Yes, it did.
The Beechworth. Mm-hmm.
Not a nice place.
No.
And this, yeah, I mean, this definitely... This really rubbed Ned the wrong way. You know, Sir Redmond Barry was the judge of the case. What a name that is, eh? He ended up sentencing Mrs. Kelly to, yeah, prison, 3 years. That's insane. And then the two males, the two guys, yeah, there was rewards put out for Ned and Dan, who were now in hiding. And it was funny because the rewards started really low, and then it just slowly built up to be, like, record-breaking, like, rewards for bushrangers in, like, in history, and it lasted for a really long time, which is kind of crazy. But yeah, this is where it all kind of kicks off, the most infamous rampage, really.
Yeah, basically. And this is where Ned and Dan are together, and they're hiding in the bush, they're on the lam, they're angry as hell for, and they want to avenge their mother and the rest of their family slash their neighbor. And so, yeah, this is the kind of where it starts to get interesting. Well, even more interesting. This was a quote from a story here that, okay, I'll read out. So when four troopers came searching around Stringy Bark Creek a few weeks later, the Kelly brothers, along with Steve Hart, age 20, and Joe Burns, age 19, shot three of them dead. When the fourth trooper escaped and managed to get back into town with a report, or sorry, the fourth trooper managed to escape and get back to town to report what had happened. So there you are. They're just mercilessly killing cops now. And this is where the Kelly gang, as it has been known to the historical annals of time.
Yeah, it was born.
Was actually born. Yeah.
Very
and
cool.
Yeah, this became more and more legendary. The more papers wrote about him and the more they basically just tried to enact their vengeance. The public was frightened, enraged. Some were just enthralled by these exploits. And yeah, it was a wild time.
Everything about this story to me is just like, I mean, obviously it's terrible. Like, I mean, it's full of death and destruction, obviously. So it's like, I'm like, oh yeah, cool. Shot three cops. Like, that's not really what I'm nodding about. But there's like a whimsical element to this story in a way, just because of the historical narrative of it. Like, and that's why people love this guy, and he was kind of seen as a Robin Hood figure, like, you know, fighting back against the man, right? But I just wanted to come back to this because I love this name, that like him and Dan, they went into hiding in the Wombat Ranges. I love that. That's just so Australian. Couldn't get more Australian.
Totally,
that,
yeah,
right? Near a man's field, but they're hiding out in the Wombat Ranges, probably eating wombats to survive, I would imagine, something like that, who knows. Anyway, but yeah, this is where he starts to really get into, like, you know what, I'm done with horses and cows and I'm going to start robbing banks. Seems like a better idea. I suppose they were just more in the outback before. There weren't really any banks to rob necessarily.
Well, they weren't gangsters yet.
They though. Weren't. Yeah, they exactly.
Were
just,
they were cattle gangsters.
Yeah, they weren't on Different the run breed. As much. That's right. Although some of these banks were in pretty small places, but like in 1878, they held up one of the national banks at Eurora. Am I saying that right? Euroa in Victoria for around £2,000. Decent chunk of change.
I wonder what the equivalent is.
Yeah, I had that. I believe it was like a couple hundred grand or something. I think I have it down here a little further. But yeah, it was no small amount of money. It was just, they cleaned out the entire bank for a town of what, like, you know, over 3,000 people or something like that. But before the bank hold up, the gang seized what was called Faithful's Creek Station as a place to kind of like leave their horses and like get all set up. They changed their clothes there. They cut the telegraph lines by the railway line nearby so that no communication could come into the town. Like, Ned was not stupid. He wasn't just a country bumpkin that was out on a killing spree. That's the cool thing about Ned Kelly. But everyone at the station who happened to come by ended up being held hostage. So he took a ton of hostages in the storeroom. And
like peacefully took them?
Yeah, well, I mean, nobody was reported to be killed. They probably got gun butted and slapped and whatever else. Who knows? That's my best guess.
Yeah, roughed right? up a little bit.
Roughed up a little bit. And then shortly after this, he ends up leaving and moving on to Geraldine. This is in New South Wales. So this is just a few months later. He ends up stealing £2,000 in this small town, too.
Did you say Geraldine?
Did I say Geraldine?
Geraldry.
Did we just watch that episode of Bob's Burgers with Geraldine?
Yeah, I
think
so. That's
just stuck in my head.
That Drilldery.
Drilldery.
What if that's New fun, South Wales.
That's a fun word to say. Okay, thank you for correcting me there. Anyway, so a couple months later, they're in the small town. They're just ganking cash. They've got tons now. And let's remember one thing here. We said this at the beginning. Anyone can shoot them on sight. Okay, and guns are everywhere, okay? Like, this is before Australia took them all away, I'm pretty sure, right? And bank owners had them and people had them. So, like, this is, like, super ballsy because they're just barging in, taking hostages, doing all this stuff, and everyone was afraid, which is pretty crazy.
That was pretty gnarly.
Massive bounty on their head, too, right? It wasn't just that they could be shot on sight. They had a pretty good chunk of change. I believe it was the equivalent of, like, 50 grand or something, and it kept climbing. It just kept climbing because nobody could catch these guys.
Really?
So they ended up relieving the bank here of the same amount, 2,000 pounds. They chopped down the telegraph poles again, and they locked the police of the city in their own cells, which is awesome.
Hmm. Along with booking the cost of shoeing their horses to the police.
Yeah, apparently. Yeah. So it held, you know, more than 30 hostages again. And then, yeah, they ended up... burning mortgages and that were held in the bank's safe. And this was all just in 3 days that they did this. And this was just like four guys, basically. Small little crew, the Kelly Gang. Pretty badass. But yeah, I mean, no person aware of Ned Kelly's presence there really took advantage of this at all. So this is what it was. $260,000 at the time would have been rewarded for his capture.
The equivalent today? Or? Yeah,
the equivalent today.
Okay.
Which is a lot of money for...
That, it is, yeah.
Considering all you have to do is shoot the guy.
$250,000, yeah.
Right? Anyway, this is kind of a weird thing, though. This is where he spent 3 days there, and we're not going to get into this part in any great detail, but he ended up writing this pretty lengthy, like, letter, essentially, and it's known as the Drilldery Letter, and it's like a manifesto. It wasn't published until, like, years and years later, like 100 years later. But basically, it was like, it's a 40-page document that was written by Ned Kelly that is basically him talking about his life as kind of like an attempt at justifying his actions, like talking about why he's done what he's done and everything leading up to what would be his eventual death. The interesting thing about this letter is that it's now seen as like an early call for an Australian republic because it was obviously like very, very critical of like police and the crown and the whole Protestant, you know, like prejudice against him and his family and everything else like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is another part of the lore of him being seen as like this Robin Hood figure.
That's pretty cool. And that definitely like speaks to his intelligence too, right? Like, you know, and his ability to rally people if he is so notorious, he definitely, and got away with it for so long too. He definitely had a following, eh?
Oh God. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitely had a
That's
following.
Kind of a shame it didn't surface until like 100 years later, though.
It's surprising, kind of. Like, yeah. He tried to publish it there. Like, he tried to, like, have it, like, professionally published in the short time he was there, but they couldn't stay. Like, 3 days was a long time to lock police in their own cells and hold hostages and stuff. Like, yeah Australia's spread out at this time.
With no one noticing, what have you,
but... That's, yeah, you kind of got to like make haste at this point, right? So at this point, like obviously they piece the scene and now, so it's Ned, Dan Kelly, Joe Burns, and Steve Hart. So the four of them, the Kelly Gang, the bounty on their head, dead or alive at this point, is up to 3,000 pounds. And the banks and the colonies chipped in as well. So in the end, it was around 8,000, like around 8,000 pounds, roughly. So about 850 grand.
Wow.
Almost $1 million bucks.
Almost.
Like getting up towards that. That's pretty wild. Dead or alive. God damn.
Crazy.
Yeah. So anyway, highest reward ever offered for the capture of a bushranger in Australia. And that comes from Australian Folk Stories. So Australian, yeah, folkstories.com. You guys should check it out. Okay. It's about time we talk about the suits, the suit of metal.
You already alluded to this. Yeah. This is pretty interesting.
Because it's pretty badass. So basically, around 1879, the Kelly Gang came up with this idea of creating armor that they were using from mold boards, which essentially were just like slabs of metal that they were taking off farm equipment, basically. They would experiment with different types of farm equipment. Some were more penetrable than others, and they kind of did some trial and error and figured out that mold boards were the best. And that's, also super heavy.
I guess if you're out in the bush too, you have some time on your hands.
You definitely do. And this is, we'll get into this in a sec, but they actually ended up testing the, the suits later on, way, way, way later on, to see where they were actually manufactured in the bush. Because you could tell, or you could definitely tell between like professional versus a bush blacksmith, because they could only get it to a certain temperature and it would just like show different campfires, like streaks in the metal and stuff. It was just really cool. But anyway, they were just literally, they're beating these things into shape, like pretty crudely out in the bush, right? It was just like hammers and stuff. And some farmers did sympathize with the Kelly gang and they offered up metal from their farms, and others began to kind of, you know, participate. While on the other side, people would report them being stolen. So the path, the little breadcrumb trail of the Kelly gang was kind of being left by this track of stolen armor equipment, basically, right?
You would think too, even maybe if the farmers were sympathetic and were just offering them, then they would maybe have to turn around and report it too, just because they don't want to be embroiled as accomplices.
I guess you could always just play dumb though and be like, oh, true, I didn't even know it was stolen.
I guess.
But then they could just get arrested for no reason, probably. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there was one police officer, though, that was kind of like, he was on to this, and he was an informer, so he's like undercover. So, he wasn't a police officer. He worked for the police as an informer. His name was Daniel Kennedy. And basically, he was going around and taking these reports and trying to like catch the trail of the Kelly gang by following these stolen boards and stuff like that. Right. He's the one who figured out how the suits were made, and he would report back to the police what they were up against, essentially. So the suits were basically made from, random pieces of metal. They looked very much, it reminded me of like the knight's armor from Monty Python, with like the, like, it almost looks like a can of soup helmet, like a tin can helmet.
Yeah.
And then just like very, very generic, like a barrel chest kind of a shape, and then just like shoulder and arm coverings. And then I don't even remember if there's leg coverings. We do have a image down below. We'll get to it in a sec. But so to be clear again, it was the Kelly gang. So Joe Byrne, Steve Hart, Dan Kelly, they're making their own suits of armor and helmets by themselves in the bush.
Pretty gnarly.
So that they can go fight cops wearing suits of metal. In the 1870, like, this is so awesome. I'm just like elated with this story. It's so cool.
It's pretty badass. Pretty inventive.
Yeah.
I feel like that was missing out of the Orlando Bloom movie.
I wonder. We actually didn't watch it. We have to check it out.
I have seen it in the past, long time ago.
A long time ago.
I just remember a lot of them sitting in these like really like stick-like woods and stuff, and just kind of chilling and figuring stuff out, and then getting into shootouts and la la la. And yeah, that was basically it. And I think they all die in the end.
Well, that's very fitting of the story.
Yeah.
So, getting back to the suits here, they were heavy, man. These things were like a quarter of an inch thick of just straight iron. And they've got like, they're wielding two pistols and shooting cops and like getting away. Because this worked. They rocked these for a while. It wasn't just for their final shootout.
Yeah. And according to these, this diagram, it says 91 pounds. That's how much it weighed. So that's like an extra like human on you.
That's heavy. Damn. And we will post this picture when we put the episode up, and it'll be on the website too. And it's just hilarious. And you guys can see them. They used to be in private collections, but they are on display in different museums and stuff now. They kind of got slowly pieced back together, and it was pretty hilarious. There was, they were all mismatched after the massacre. They had to like work really, really hard to get the owners of the private collections to actually like agree to swap so that they could put back together the originals, because everyone had like a bit, little bit of Dan's, a little bit of Ned's, a little bit of Joe's, a little bit of this, like just random bits. And they have been able to repiece together some of the original suits of armor, which is really, really sweet.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So like I was saying before, some people thought that these were made by like professional blacksmiths. So blacksmiths were getting interviewed and targeted and stuff. Like, they were trying to find out if some people were really helping the Kelly gang, like, make some gnarly suits of armor. And that's been like the word of the day. I feel like I've said it at least 4 or 5 times.
I've said it a few times too.
That just like, I don't even know. It just like works well with this group.
Yeah.
I just feel like you're in the bush, you're in Australia. That is just a good word for these folks. Straight up. They got beards. they're looking real gnarly. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Anyway, but as I said before as well, later tests would show that basically it was proven that they were forged by the boys themselves in a bush forge. So no more than 7 to 750 degrees, which was basically the maximum temperature you could achieve. Just makeshift blacksmith out in the middle of nowhere, essentially, mm-hmm. which is pretty insane. So these guys would have had to use some serious brute force to actually form these suits into place. Like, this is raw iron we're talking about here.
And it looks very well formed when you look at it. Hey? Yeah,
they were committed. The inspiration for the suits is an interesting point of contention because nobody really knows where the Kelly Gang got the idea other than just to be, like, not hit by bullets, I guess. Anyone could come up with that, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. But, well, they're obviously taking inspiration from times since past, right? The medieval era.
Well, I mean, clearly, because that's exactly what it looked like. But I mean, there were other, like, more local influences, I suppose you would say. So some people thought that they were kind of taking influences by performers, like witnessing performers basically showing Chinese history, right? Like where they had those similar kind of suits of armor where it's like the big bulky chests. Although I think they had different sort of like a different leg pattern.
I thought those weren't made of metal though. I thought those were made of silk.
Yeah, but the shape is the same.
Okay.
I mean, obviously these guys don't have access to silk. So good they're point. Not going to make them. But yeah, I don't know. The Chinese were also... Like, there were sympathizers because they were also a heavily persecuted group of people, along with the Irish and many other immigrants in places like Australia, Canada, the United States, everywhere, basically.
They're right? Underdogs all over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There is one other theory, though. This one's kind of cool. Allegedly, Ned's favorite book was written in 1869. It was called Lorna Doone. So... I've never heard of this, set in 17th century England, and it was basically about a family of outlaws, very fitting for Ned to enjoy, right?
Ooh,
and
yeah.
Essentially, yeah, like they were wearing iron plates on a lot of the characters in the book to like basically survive, describes them on horseback wearing suits of armor. So that's a theory that he took influence from his favorite book.
That's cool.
Which that also implies that he's well-read.
Yeah, exactly. And if he came up with that document, like I said again, right, he's obviously, what's the word I'm looking for? He is able to read and write.
Well, he's literate.
Literate, that's the word.
That's the word.
English is hard.
English is tough. Words we are very tired right now.
Well.
We're enjoying this story, though.
Yeah.
It's
getting to the end of the, you know, it's Sunday night. We had a long weekend. Holy moly, like this weekend felt like a long weekend, like legitimate. August long weekend.
It really did.
But yeah, no, this is fun. This is our decompression time.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. So thank you guys for letting us record this for you.
Yeah. You're the best. We really appreciate it.
So anyway, these guys, they figured out how to build these things. They're rocking these just gangster suits of armor, robbing banks left and right. And by this point, essentially the gang has been completely outlawed, right? So like, you know, dead or alive. And is basically for the three, the murders of those three police officers at Stringy Bark Creek. That was the main one because there was actually like a witness to it. So it wasn't just kind of like a he said, she said, because there was other bushrangers out there killing people too, right? And there's no DNA. There's no like people investigating being like, this is for sure the Kelly Gang that killed this guy over here. And now they're in Drildery, right? So this was like definitive because there was a police officer that got back.
True. And they would have been able to extract the bullets too and would have been able to compare and be like, oh, these guys, you know, they're known to have carried this and this weapon or something and blah, blah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this all comes to a head essentially, and you could call it retribution for the cops, and maybe they were just, they had had enough of these guys and they really made their last stand at Glen Rowan. So this is a small town in Victoria. And before we get into this last stand that is just pretty epic, we have a promo break.
Yeah, we're going to break for All Things Dreams podcast. This is one of our strange network members. Miranda is the host. And this is just such an interesting podcast.
So cool.
It dives into all things related to dreams. She's a really, really entertaining woman and host, I should say, you know. And I'm also really excited for her contribution that's going to be on the blog Definitely. That we're launching pretty quick here. So that's another thing to look forward to from us that we mentioned right off the bat. But yeah, I'm really looking forward. So let's give it up for All Things Dreams.
Hi, folks. My name is Miranda McLaughlin, and I'm the host of All Things Dreams. a podcast dedicated to dream experiences and dream interpretation. Are you curious about dreams but don't have time for all that pesky research? Well, then you're in luck, because you can leave the research to me and just tune into All Things Dreams, where we discuss loads of different dream experiences, dream themes, and dream topics like sleep paralysis, lucid dreaming, inception dreams, and so much more. Just check us out wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
And we're back. So yeah, make sure you go check out All Things Dreams, and you can head over to, yeah, straightupstrange.com, and you can find, yeah, her there and everyone else, which is pretty sweet.
Mm-hmm.
So we're getting down to the final standoff here. The suits of armor, they're in their glorious fashion and final display out in the glimmering sun against the police that have finally tracked these guys down. So at this point in time, like we said, they're in Glen Rowan, small town in Victoria. So the four of them, they joined up. Essentially, Byrne and Dan were separate from the two when they moved into Glen Rowan. So Ned and Hart were already there, as far as I can gather from some of the sources we've looked at. So basically, they took over the hotel, very much like they had done at all these other places they went through, whether it was a hotel or whatever. They found a place to board up. It was owned and operated by this woman by the name of Mrs. Ann Jones. And yeah, in very Kelly gang fashion, detained about 60 people.
Managing that between four individuals, eh?
I know, right? They basically knew everything that was going on in the town. They were really prepared. So they knew that there was a train arriving at a certain time from Melbourne. Their intention was to kind of like sabotage the railway tracks. So tear up some of the rails and basically force some of the workers to do this for them. So they had schemes to try to like basically hold up this town and get out alive. It never really came to anything, because there was this guy by the name of Thomas Cunro. So he was actually held hostage, and he was alleged, I think he was a school teacher or something like that.
He was at the hotel then?
He was at the hotel, and he actually allowed him to leave the hotel with his wife, his child, and his sister, because this is, again, the Robin Hood narrative. I guess this guy was nice. We saw he had a wife and kid. Clearly didn't do anything wrong to Ned. Maybe he had some sort of Irish descent.
Maybe.
Who knows?
Yeah.
And he let him go. So that's kind of interesting, right? But basically, these guys were getting pretty cocky, because the story goes that they were drinking. They were basically just getting drunk. They didn't really drink. They didn't sleep much. They seemed to just be, I don't know, having a good time and like pretty cocky that they held up this entire place. And they hadn't been killed yet. They've been robbing banks and doing their thing.
Yeah, just running loose and wild, eh?
Yeah, this is definitely kind of the downfall for sure.
Getting overconfident here.
Yeah, I think the suits of armor were definitely a fallacy for them. They felt completely like invincible with those suits of armor, because they basically, and they don't even have good movement in these things, right? Like we said, they weigh over 90 pounds.
Yeah.
And you're wielding firearms at the same time.
They are separate pieces that are kind of like linked together, but at the same time, yeah, that would be awkward and a lot to maneuver with.
Definitely. And the police knew what they were up against by this point too, because of the informants and because of like, you know, previous incidents. But this one particular guy, Superintendent Hare, He had been leading the case against the Kelly gang for some time, organized this entire standoff. They surrounded the hotel, and this is where the shooting began. They unloaded on the hotel, essentially.
With hostages inside?
Yeah, I guess. What? I guess they knew we're in a relatively secure location, and that Kelly and Hart, they basically, Kelly, Hart and the gang, they exit the hotel. They're not just inside. They basically come out with their suits of armor. Hare gets shot in the arm, the superintendent. And then Ned is allegedly wounded in the foot, because of course his feet weren't protected. His suit of armor was notorious for just having the shoulders and chest plate, and then like this massive tin can helmet with this really tiny slit for the eyes. Just like totally Monty Python-esque. That's all I can think of right now.
I know, right?
he gets shot in the foot. He also gets shot in the hand, and as well as the arm, because of course it's not covering his entire arm. The rest of them take refuge inside the hotel, and Ned runs off into the bush. So this is how the story goes.
Okay.
Basically, the police don't let up at all. So Byrne is shot We don't know if he's dead yet. It was in the thigh, but he was possibly shot in the torso as well. He ended up bleeding to death much like a little later on. Mm-hmm. This is like 5 a.m. now. Ned was hiding in the bush and he returns still wearing his armor. So he goes out and he waits it out for a few hours while the police are still staking out the hotel. He comes out. Obviously, he's been bleeding. And the legend and lore of this was that it was a very misty early morning at 5 a.m. And he basically like emerges from the woods as like this like monstrosity, like looking like a robot with his crazy helmet on and stuff.
Yeah.
Like with his double pistols, like ready to rock, right?
Pretty crazy. Before you get into the very, very end, this is funny. Like, I just want to read out some of these papers, right? Because there was lots that covered this shootout, right? And what happened. And some of these papers, this was one, a capture read, or a caption. Glen Rowan, Monday night. At last, the Kelly gang and the police have come within shooting distance, and the adventure has been the most tragic of any in the bushranging annals of the colony. Most people will say that it is high time, too, for the murders of the police near Mansfield occurred as long ago as the 26th of October, 1878, and the Uroa outrage of December 9th of the same year, as well as the Girildry affair on the 8th and 9th of February, 1879.
Yeah.
Another one read, this was from a local paper called The Age, said, quote, many shots hit him, yet he always recovered himself.
Yeah.
And tapping his breast, laughed derisively as he coolly returned their fire, end quote.
Badass.
Pretty badass.
Yeah. Pretty crazy. So, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, most of these so he gets shot a bunch in the legs and eventually he was brought down. We don't even know how many times he was actually hit in the legs before he collapsed.
I wonder.
This is like Scarface shit right here. Mm-hmm. Just getting, like, he just won't die. It's awesome. It's crazy. So yeah, most of the captives, they succeeded in leaving the building. They hid successfully inside the hotel, with the last of them kind of coming out around 10 a.m. ish. And yeah, there was one guy who was fatally shot by a police bullet. Yeah, there was a few. Oh, actually, there was one other that did die. This John Jones, son of the hotel keeper, he was shot in the abdomen. He died later in hospital. But Ned was captured. Byrne was dead. Dan and Hart were not accounted for. But basically, the police continued to fire sporadically until around 3 p.m. So this goes on literally a full day, all night, and then into the next day and like the afternoon. That's pretty insane.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah, at this point, the police seem to be either running out of bullets or running out of ideas, and they basically set the building on fire because there's no hostages left in it, and they're just like, screw it, let's flush these guys out by lighting this on fire.
Jeez.
Oh, man. Yeah, yeah. And of course, after the fact, they did find bodies inside. Burns was brought out by the police. The other two were those of Dan and Hart, so they didn't make it. Dan's the only survivor, or rather, Kelly, Ned Kelly. Is the only survivor of any of this. He's arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And of course he didn't die, right? Like everyone else goes down. Ned doesn't go down. And he's basically, yeah, tried. So October 20th to 29th, 1880 in Melbourne, he's tried for the murders of the police officers at Stringy Bark Creek. He's obviously found guilty by Judge Redmond Barry. And he's of course sentenced.
Again with the Redmond Barry.
Same dude. Don't you think there's a conflict of interest there?
Perhaps.
In a way? Is that even allowed? I don't even know. I mean, obviously back then.
I guess. There's not a lot of judges around, I'd imagine, maybe.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So he's sentenced to death. He's sentenced to be hung at Melbourne, right? The 11th of November. And he basically met his end just like a boss. So he goes up there and the literal quote is, well, I suppose it had to come to this. That's it. With a smile on his face. There's another version where he literally just looks at him and they say any last words and he just says, such is life.
Very,
pretty crazy.
Very quaint.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty gnarly, man. Yeah.
So the suit of armor didn't really work out in the end, but,
well, but that's just it though. It's like, yeah, the suit of armor means that you are really trying to survive, right? You're not just going, well, to a certain extent, it goes both ways. So because then you feel, like we said before, more invincible. And that kind of gives you a false sense of security. And ergo, you get a little too cocky. And this is what happens. That sucks, though, about Dan and Hart. How they just, like, they poisoned themselves, eh? And then they were just burned beyond
That's a shitty way to go. A shitty way to go.
Yeah.
Not the same as Kelly's was, had a little more dignity for sure.
Yeah.
And he just, and he ended up being super famous because of it. Right. And this is where we're getting into, like, we're coming down to the end of this episode, but there's this kind of a turn here because this is almost like its own episode in and of itself, because there's this very, very famous movie made about the Kelly Gang. It's called The Story of the Kelly Gang, and it came out in 1906, and it has become one of the most infamous missing films of all time, which is pretty bizarre.
Same year as the San Francisco earthquake.
Yeah. Weird, right?
Yeah.
So it was literally the world's first ever full-length film, which sounds kind of crazy. It was the longest of its time, recorded in 1906. So, but like the film reels went completely missing.
Okay. So we don't really know how long it was.
Well, we do know. It was, it was around just over an hour. It was like an hour and 6 minutes or something like that.
Oh, I
in
see.
Its full entirety. So it was showed in Melbourne and Victoria, like in theaters, and it was met with different reaction across the country. Let's just say that.
Mm-hmm.
Today, there's only been 25% pieced back together of its original like roughly hour, which is kind of
really
sad.
Is that like available online?
Yes, it is. So we have the YouTube clip in our show notes, so cool. You guys will be able to check that out. And yeah, so we'll have it on the website and stuff like that. It's interesting for sure. So basically, I mean, Kelly, of course, was killed long before the thing was shot. But basically he's, you know, the subject of interest by all because of his classic, being a classic thug, bushranger, murderer, depending on who you're talking to. Right. But the early
it's
turn
perfect
of this,
for Hollywood.
Well, it is exactly right. So, but like at the early turn of the century, it was possible to bring film to the masses now. It wasn't really before. It was only really done so on a short scale, like super short movies, like 2-3 minutes, 6 minutes, 12 minutes. That was like the longest that you would come up with, right?
Reminds me of like the Murdoch era film.
Where, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Totally. So obviously it was going to take a little longer to tell the story of the Kelly Gang because this went on for a long time. They raided a bunch of cities. They robbed a bunch of banks. They killed a bunch of people. This couldn't just be done in 12 minutes. So one of Australia's earliest movie exhibitors, this guy's name was Charles Tate. Doesn't that sound like a famous name?
Charles Tate.
I don't like, it just does anyway.
Yeah.
He decided to take the story head on. So he shot the world's first ever full-length feature film, showcasing all the glorious violence that came to be expected from basically later on noirs and stuff like that, like the Bogarts much later on that were still considered pretty risque.
Yeah, like the 40s. That would have been pretty racy then because like a lot of people weren't used to seeing or even like there was no sound at this point, right? So it was just images and a lot of them were very pastoral. They're very everyday, commonplace images. Yeah. You don't really show violent acts on film at this point.
Exactly. So it airs in 1906 and essentially just shocked the masses. So co-producers Millard Johnson and William Gibson, they produced this film over just over an hour, action-packed, shoot 'em up classic, basically. So featuring this guy by the name of Frank Mills, who stars as Ned Kelly. Nick Brierley plays the classic member of the Kelly Gang, Joe Byrne. They managed to basically get funding of around $1,000 in modern day funds. So not that much money, like pretty low budget film. Right. But they made it work and the film aired for the first time at the Athenian Hall in Melbourne on Boxing Day, 1906, which is pretty cool.
Cool.
And the response was interesting. Some loved it while others were absolutely appalled at the violence that it displayed. Like it was glorifying violence and you can picture some of the Protestant community and what have you. Seeing this ruthless gangster and killer essentially glorified on screen as a superhero in a way. But either way, it was a massive success. So it circulates Australia. It was playing packed houses. Like people were waiting in line around the block to come see this because it was so violent. There were even live narrations. So at this time there was no sound, like you were just saying. So they had live narrations with live sound effects with people using blank rounds fired so that it sounded like all the madness.
Wow. That's pretty cool. That's like half theater, half film.
Exactly. Yeah. How cool is that? Right. So anyway, the film even actually caused some copycat fans. So there were groups of young kids that were allegedly, you know, responsible for holding up different things. Like one held a group gang held up a photo studio in Victoria at gunpoint and basically using lines that were known to be from the Kelly Gang.
A group of young school children.
Yeah, young thugs. This is basically what the article is trying to
That's
say.
That's too funny.
But this happened, I guess, at several other places across the country. And it makes sense, right? It's very much like movies today. People are heavily influenced.
Definitely, yeah.
And then in 1907, the following year, it goes international. So it airs in New Zealand, followed by Great Britain. But then, of course, cinema was moving very, very quickly. And then by the end of the Second World War, like, obviously, it's basically completely lost. Like, the gangster films of the 20s, 30s, and 40s, they were showcasing more violence and lasting well over an hour. And the story of the Kelly Gang kind of got forgotten. It was kind of left on a dusty shelf. Yet, when it was remembered in the 1960s, and it wanted to be, they wanted to put it in like the Australian like film archives, the reels were really nowhere to be found. Not a single complete fragment was found anywhere.
It's like the Smithsonian.
Very much so. It's bizarre. It is almost like someone who hated the film sabotaged it or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until 1976 that a few very, very short fragments of it popped up in a private collection in Adelaide.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And this was consisting of literally like 2 minutes, like very, very small amounts, like per reel.
Hmm. But was there damage to them, I wonder?
No, like, they were complete, but they were basically like the originals that were used for like editing together, like shooting frame by frame.
Okay.
So they weren't like the finished copy. They were like real, I guess, or something like that, right? Like they hadn't been clipped together into the full.
Exactly.
Like the original full length copy was just gone, like just completely gone.
Mm-hmm. That's a shame.
Yeah. And then basically a few years later after that, they started to pop up elsewhere. So some in Melbourne from another collector. I think there was a few in America as well. And then believe it or not, there was a couple of reels found literally at a garbage dump in the 1980s in a box. And thank God somebody saw it, recognized it as something old and might be cool.
Man, all the stuff has been thrown away. Hey, over the
Imagine finding that gem at a garbage dump, a piece of the Ned Kelly film. That's so cool.
Yeah, that would be really cool.
You guys got to go check this out. We will definitely have the link, like I said, because it's super fun. It's really interesting to see. And of course, they depict the suits of armor and the final shootout. It's pretty sweet.
Pretty gnarly.
So yeah, I mean,
just one more gnarly.
The modern interpretations do not stand up. Let's just say that. The 1906, even if it's just 12 minutes, takes the cake for me. I haven't seen the Orlando Bloom version. I haven't seen the operas, but it's pretty sweet.
Yeah. Okay. Mm. Well, I think you would just be disappointed with the Orlando Bloom version.
Yeah, I'm
even
sure
though Heath Ledger's in it too, but you know,
I like both those actors.
They both had Lemons movies.
Yeah.
I'm not, it's been so long since I've seen that. I really can't make a judgment call, but
fair enough.
Yeah.
So we're at the end. That's the story of the Kelly Gang. Ned Kelly and the Kelly Gang.
That's it.
Man.
It was a brutal ending. It was a short-lived affair and definitely just, like we said right off the bat, it was just a life of desperation, of vengeance, and of constantly feeling like you're a second-class citizen to a certain degree, seemingly, hey?
Yeah, so much so that you had to build a suit of armor and just steal a ton of cash and go on a murdering rampage.
Exactly.
Pretty badass. So, where does he rank for you in terms of like the greatest like historical badass list?
Up there? I don't know. I don't have a
like
list.
How do you perceive him after this story? Like, do you see him as a little bit of a Robin Hood figure?
Well, I definitely see him as a controversial one by any account.
Do you trust this guy?
No, I don't think I would. I think it was a very cutthroat situation that he was in Australia at that time, especially. And, you know, you kind of make do with what you got. And who knows how all that cattle stealing and horse stealing really started. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I just wanted a steak, man.
I'm going to turn that question on you then. What do you think?
I fully think that he had the potential to be a person that made a way bigger impact on the world, even though he has made an impact on the world just in a different way as being like a famous, you know, a famous bushranger now, because he clearly, I don't know, like it's interesting to think about like what people could be in different like eras. You know what I mean? Like what would Ned Kelly be in the 60s? Would he be an outlaw? Like, or would he be like a rock star or something? Like,
would he,
like,
be a wrestler?
Sure. Would he be like, would he be a Conor McGregor? Would he be a boxer? Would he be like, right? Like, would it be something different? You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
But I'm definitely digging on his story. I'm a Ned fan for sure. Because cops were the worst back then.
Especially if they were out for you.
They were out for it. And my favorite part of the story, hands down, is the suit of armor. Because it's just, you don't hear that every day.
No, that's pretty badass.
Yeah. Forging it yourself in the bush where everything in there is going to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
Including the people who know you have a bounty on your head. Mm-hmm. What a life.
What yep. a life. Short, anyway. Brutal life.
Indeed.
Poor Ned.
Poor Ned. Well, we want to hear what you guys think. Yeah. So if you don't already, follow us on social media and you can hit us up there and like make comment on our posts and stuff and like let us know what you think of this episode or if you want future episodes that we haven't covered. So yeah, at Into the Portal Podcast on Instagram. Same thing on Twitter, at Into the Portal 1, Into the Portal Podcast on Instagram. And we have a forum going on there. So come and join the forum. And you can always shoot us emails as well. We love getting your emails at intotheportalmailbox@gmail.com.
Exactly. And of course, like we said already, go check up our, check out, I should say.
Check out.
Check them up and check them out. Our fellow podcast, Strange Crew members over at Straight Definitely. Up Strange. Yeah, go check out that lineup.
Yeah, straightupstrange.com. Super simple, but we have really cool things coming down the pipe for that website. So stay tuned for that. And until next time on Into the Portal.
Your gateway to the bizarre.
This podcast is a part of Straight Up Strange Productions. Discover more shows like this one at straightupstrange.com.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.